Welcome, bienvenido, bienvenue, caribou, willkommen, strasswischer, namaste, ni hao, merhaba, yate habin. Welcome to EPID 160, Principles of Epidemiology for Public Health. My name is Vic Schoenbach. I've been a member of the faculty in the Department of Epidemiology since 1980. I've been teaching EPI 160 only since fall 2001, but before that I taught EPI 168, the introductory course for EPID majors, for over 20 years. My co-faculty member in this course is Lorraine Alexander, who has been with EPI 168 since 1994. In fact, she and Carl Shai, with the help of a number of our best doctoral students, developed the distance learning version of this course. It is thanks to Lorraine that I am able to teach in this course, since I am still learning from her how it works. I would like to congratulate you on your decision to learn epidemiology. Even if you are taking this course only because it is required for your program, you deserve to be congratulated for signing up for a program that requires epidemiology. Teaching this course has a special meaning for me. I took EPI 160 for the first time in the fall of 1972, when I was a master's student in the Department of Health Education, now called HEBE. The course was taught by John Castle, who was then chair of the Department of Epidemiology. John Castle was an inspiring man. You can see him in the picture on this slide. He pioneered community-oriented primary care in South Africa in the 1940s and 50s. His work in providing health care to Africans, however, was not appreciated by the apartheid government, so he had to leave South Africa and came to Chapel Hill as the first permanent chairperson of the Department of Epidemiology. A believer in multidisciplinary perspectives, Dr. Castle broadened the department by bringing in sociologists, psychologists, and anthropologists, and several practicing physicians to join the faculty. He launched the first community-based cardiovascular disease cohort study in a biracial community, the Evans County Study, and was one of the founders of the field of social epidemiology. Epidemiology is fundamentally engaged in the broader quest for social justice and equality. This is the way that John Castle characterized epidemiology during the discussion in which he invited Dr. Sherman James to join the epidemiology faculty at UNC. Dr. James recounted the incident when he presented the John Castle seminar several years ago. It is a perspective that one doesn't hear often at epidemiology meetings today, but it defines a mission for our field that we should never lose sight of. Whenever you open the box of a new product you have purchased, the first thing you encounter is a set of cautions for using the product safely. I haven't had the opportunity yet to write a set of cautions for EPI 160, so I'm providing several that I found in a column by Ann Landers. These were allegedly actual instructions. For a Marks and Spencer bread pudding, product will be hot after heating. For a Rowenta iron, do not iron clothes on body. For Nitol, which is a sleep aid, warning, may cause drowsiness. And for a kitchen knife, warning, keep out of children. Good advice to be sure. A few more cautions before we proceed, just to be sure that we've all been warned. On a set of Christmas lights, for indoor or outdoor use only. On a package of Sainsbury's peanuts, warning, contains nuts. On an American Airline nuts package, instructions, open packet, eat nuts. On a chainsaw, do not attempt to stop chain with your hands. Definitely an important public health message. Don't say that I didn't warn you. This is a picture of my wife and me when we were students in EPI 160 in 1972. She was an MPH student in health administration at the time, now called HPAA. We met in PUB 100, Principles of Public Health, a school-wide required core course that no longer exists. I'm sorry they eliminated that course. I certainly got a lot out of it. But enough autobiography. I imagine that someone, perhaps a friend, relative, or coworker, has asked you what you are taking this semester. When you said epidemiology, you probably received one of these typical responses. You're studying what? Or maybe, does that have something to do with skin? Or perhaps just, uh-huh, and what else are you studying? So one thing that I hope you will learn in this course is a way to explain epidemiology to people. What is epidemiology? There are a number of definitions of epidemiology. One of my favorites is the one in John Last's Dictionary of Epidemiology, the study of the distribution and determinants of health-related states and events in populations, and the application of this study to control health problems. Let's examine the definition phrase by phrase. The definition refers to the distribution of health-related states. Epidemiology studies where diseases are found in the population, who gets them, for example, young people or older people, women or men, where they occur, for example, in urban areas, rural areas, industrialized countries, developing countries, and the patterns of disease occurrence by season and over time. We say distribution and determinants. Determinants because epidemiology is interested in the factors that influence the occurrence of disease, risk factors, environmental factors, and preventive factors. The object is to prevent disease, and in order to do that, we need to identify the factors that affect its occurrence. I've been saying disease as a shorthand for health-related states and events. Epidemiology can be used to study any phenomenon that exists, states, or phenomenon that occurs, events. Besides disease, epidemiology can study positive conditions, for example, immunity, and positive behaviors, for example, physical activity, as well as adverse ones. Epidemiologists are usually most interested in studying events, since once a condition has existed for some time, its antecedents are often harder to discern. However, health-related states are also important to study, since with some conditions, anxiety, depression, immunity, for example, their duration may be as or almost as important as their occurrence. Epidemiology studies populations. This aspect is one of the defining characteristics of epidemiology. In fact, the word for people is part of the derivation of the word epidemiology. Epi for upon, demos, people, logi, the study of, from the Greek. However, there are also veterinary epidemiologists who study populations of other animals. Take a look now at the last part of the definition, the application of this study to control health problems. This component of the definition is actually a point of some debate among epidemiologists, and not all definitions include it. In fact, three of my colleagues, including our department chair, published an article several years ago in the American Journal of Public Health, in which they argued that the application of the results of epidemiologic studies to disease control should not be part of epidemiology. Policymakers and health education specialists are better prepared to do that, their argument went, and though epidemiologists can become involved in disease control and advocacy as individuals, they are not acting as epidemiologists when they do so. Others, most recently Douglas Weed in an article in the Annals of Epidemiology, counter that drawing implications and advocating for policy changes should indeed be part of epidemiology, since epidemiologists are the ones most equipped to interpret the data they generate. Since some decisions involving resources and approvals are based on what is or is not epidemiology, for example, what is an acceptable topic for an epidemiology dissertation, or should this person receive a promotion in an epidemiology position, the question is somewhat consequential. What is epidemiology really? Epidemiology is the study of the health and disease of the body politic, the population. Clinicians prevent, detect, monitor, and treat disease in individual patients. Epidemiologists prevent, detect, monitor, and treat disease in populations. Epidemiology is a basic science of public health. Epidemiologic studies provide the basis for public health practice and policymaking by attempting to find out what causes disease, what causes disease to spread, what prevents disease, and what works in controlling disease. Of course, other disciplines are concerned with these questions too. Many fields evaluate programs, for example. One difference is that epidemiologists emphasize evaluation in relation to health outcomes rather than to processes, such as utilization of services. However, epidemiologists are not the only professionals concerned with health outcomes, nor with the cause and dissemination of disease. But when other people study health and disease in populations, then they are practicing epidemiology. I am beating the drum not so much for epidemiologists as I am for epidemiology. So, what is epidemiology good for? Milton Terrace, one of the leaders in the development of the modern profession of epidemiology, summarized the uses of the field in an article on the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Society for Epidemiologic Research. Terrace lists 7 primary uses of epidemiology. First, to provide the scientific basis to prevent disease and injury and promote health. Second, to determine the relative importance of different health needs to establish priorities for research and action. Third, to identify sections of the population at greatest risk to enable targeting of interventions. Fourth, to evaluate effectiveness of programs in improving the health of the population. Fifth, to study the natural history of disease from precursor states through clinical course. Sixth, to conduct surveillance of disease and injury occurrence in populations. And seventh, to investigate disease outbreaks to determine their source and how to control them. Natural history of disease. Let me expand briefly on the concept of natural history of disease, a fundamental concept in epidemiology and public health. Disease is generally best understood as a process that unfolds over time. Natural history refers to the entire process of the development of a disease and its course after it manifests. In principle, natural refers to that process in the absence of intervention. Why is natural history important? In order to know if a treatment makes any difference, it is necessary to know what would happen without treatment. A knowledge of natural history is also important for disease prevention. For example, screening programs for early detection of chronic diseases must be based on an accurate understanding of the natural history of the condition. As we shall see in an upcoming lecture, early detection and screening requires that the disease have a stage during which it can be detected, but during which it would not come to medical attention without an early detection program. Moreover, treatment during this pre-symptomatic stage must be more effective than treatment after the disease becomes symptomatic. Why is that? If the treatment is no more efficacious before symptoms appear, then why bother to screen? If the same health outcome could be obtained without the costs and logistical challenges of screening by just waiting for symptoms to bring the patient to the clinic, then what good is accomplished by screening? Now I'd like to shift gears to a book by Lori Garrett. During her doctoral studies in bacteriology and immunology, Lori Garrett began working as a journalist to earn some extra money. She was so good at it and enjoyed it so much that she left microbiology for journalism, where she has been extremely successful. After a best-selling book, The Coming Plague, presented the problem of emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases and how the world was ill-prepared to cope with them, Garrett turned her attention to the collapse of the public health institutional infrastructure around the world. In her book, The Betrayal of Trust, Lori Garrett chronicles 2 major disease outbreaks that were exacerbated by the lack of an effective public health system. She then chronicles the deterioration of the public health infrastructure in Russia and the United States and some of the consequences. The following account of the 1994 outbreak of plague in India provides a vivid illustration of the importance of public health for modern society. The bubonic plague is caused by a bacterium called Yersinia pestis. Since only recently have the genetic sequences of bacteria become known, they are characterized most often by how they appear through a microscope. Yersinia pestis is shaped like a rod and is gram-negative. That means it belongs to a group of bacteria that have cell walls that prevent them from absorbing a commonly used dye, a gram stain. Yersinia pestis was responsible for the Black Death in Europe in the Middle Ages and has killed many millions of people throughout the world. The bacteria are transmitted primarily through the bite of a flea that infests black rats. Fortunately, the plague is readily treated with antibiotics, but when treatment does not begin in time, the bacteria can cause a pneumonic plague, that progresses very rapidly and can also be spread from person to person. In September 1993, a powerful earthquake leveled 1 million homes in Maharashtra state, in India. The peasants quickly harvested their crops, stored them, and then fled the area. A year later, the peasants returned to temporary housing provided by the government. They came to retrieve their stored grain, which had since been colonized by rats, who in turn were infested with fleas, which in turn were infected with Yersinia pestis. Several weeks later, 4 cases of bubonic plague were reported in Mamala in the Bid district of Maharashtra state. There were undoubtedly other cases as well, but the healthcare infrastructure had been severely disrupted by the earthquake. As a result, bubonic plague cases went undetected and untreated and developed into pneumonic plague. Several days later in Surat, a city several hundred miles away, people gathered by the river to celebrate the festival of Ganesh. Due to particularly heavy rains during the monsoon season that had just ended, the ground was still very soft in many places, so hundreds of thousands of people crowded into a narrow area by the river. Among them must have been someone infected with pneumonic plague. A week later, cases of pneumonic plague began to appear in Surat. As a result of cutbacks in funding, the public hospitals now treated a minority of patients, so the public health physicians quietly passed the word to their private colleagues to be on the lookout for plague. The response was not one that brought credit to the medical profession. 80% of the private physicians fled Surat, closing all private clinics and hospitals. As word of the outbreak spread, the middle class followed their lead, and the media, local, national, and then international, trumpeted the story, Surat fever. 500,000 people, 1/4 of Surat's population of about 2 million, departed in 1 week. People from Surat quickly dispersed around the country. Not an effective way to contain an outbreak of disease. Soon, cases of pneumonic plague began appearing in widely separated locations. 5 states in India went on emergency health alert status. Unfortunately, the Indian federal government was slow to act and ineffectual when it did act. The Minister of Health, a political appointee, was not even a physician, but a businessman. However, the World Health Organization was also ineffectual in gauging the nature of the situation and orchestrating an appropriate international response. Meanwhile, in Surat, the remaining medical personnel worked round the clock to care for the growing number of cases and became exhausted in the process. Sales of tetracycline, the antibiotic effective against plague, soared so that supplies quickly became depleted. As the international community became increasingly concerned, it emerged that there was a severe shortage of plague expertise throughout the world. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which responds to outbreaks of communicable diseases throughout the world, had only a half-time scientist who was an expert in this disease. There was no shortage of apparent expertise in the private sector, however. Indian and multinational drug companies stepped in to promote their antibiotics, other drugs, cleansers, pesticides, and rat poison, even though Yersinia was being carried by untreated people rather than by rats and fleas. As fear spread, 1/5 of tourism packages were canceled. India's traditional opponents took the opportunity to ban all commerce with India, even postal communications. The Bombay stock market crashed. In the face of bland reassurances from the WHO, countries around the world took measures to protect themselves from infected travelers from India. Russia, China, Egypt, Malaysia, and Bangladesh closed all connections, while Britain and other countries inspected all Indian travelers. The Royal Dutch airline, KLM, sprayed pesticides in cabins of planes arriving from India, a puzzling containment strategy since the infected carriers were people, not insects. In India, public schools were being closed, and as of October 2nd, less than 2 months after the first 4 cases were reported, Indian federal officials announced over 4,000 cases. The Indian federal government proved inept at dealing with the epidemic. The National Institute of Communicable Diseases and the All India Institute of Medical Sciences engaged in a standoff over custody of specimens from suspected plague victims. They declined the assistance of outside laboratories, even though their own equipment was limited and laboratory conditions were inadequate. Most of the original specimens deteriorated through the lack of proper handling so that it would prove impossible to conduct an accurate analysis of the extent of the epidemic. The lack of definitive laboratory diagnosis undercut the authority of governmental public health agencies. Alternative theories of the cause of the illnesses abounded. Some thought that the outbreak was due really to various other diseases. Others proposed that the outbreak was the result of a conspiracy by rebels or by the United States Central Intelligence Agency. These theories prompted the Ministry of Defense to take custody of the remaining blood and sputum samples, cutting out public health completely. Fortunately for India, and for the rest of the world, the outbreak subsided. But in the process, thousands of worried well filled the hospitals, there was widespread inappropriate use of antibiotics and pesticides, and trade and tourism lost $1.3 billion in revenue. The lessons learned from this experience? Public health matters. If you feel that this account portrays the Indian government unfairly, take a look at Laurie Garrett's chapters on Zaire, Russia, and the United States. India is not alone. Now we should talk a little about the course. EPI 160 is based on a cooperative learning model of adult education in which students work on structured learning tasks so that they can apply the concepts and methods they are learning. They can exercise critical judgment and confront some of the complexities of real life. Students will work in teams of about 10 members each. Teams will be paired into lab groups, each of which will have a teaching assistant who will act as a consultant. Students will have access to a variety of resources. These resources consist of, first, a course pack containing the articles for the weekly case study and also for the final paper at the end of the course. Second, a popular textbook, Epidemiology by Leon Gordas. We use the second edition. Third, the course website in Blackboard with information about the conduct of the course, as well as a glossary, formula sheet, past examinations for practice, information about the final paper, and links to resources on the web. Be sure to check out EpiGrad today. Your teaching assistant and the course faculty will answer your questions, make suggestions, and provide feedback about your responses to the case studies. And a very important resource is your fellow students, many of whom have extensive experience in public health. You will participate in a discussion forum each week, contributing your ideas around a question related to the weekly case study. There will also be a set of lecture slides and notes for each week. The lectures are designed to complement the textbook and in some cases to comment on it. Epidemiology is a relatively new field and even its fundamentals are still evolving. This evolution can make for considerable confusion since different authors and investigators use terms in different ways and make statements that reflect the era in which the writer learned epidemiology. Fortunately, the newer conceptual framework provides greater clarity than the earlier one. The lectures will try to provide the benefit of these recent developments. If you would like to read more of what I would say than is presented in the lectures, take a look at my evolving text, which I was developing during my years of teaching EPI 168, the introductory course for EPI majors at UNC. You can find it at www.epidemiolog, that's epidemiology without the G, .net. A word about the course schedule, which can be found in the syllabus folder on the course website. The internet course is designed to be equivalent to the classroom version of EPI 160. Graduate courses at UNC are designed to have 3 or 4 hours of in-class or outside work for each credit hour. Thus, the anticipated workload for EPI 160 is about 12 to 16 hours per week, including the 3 hours in class for students enrolled in the classroom version. Most weeks will involve reading a chapter or two in the textbook, reading a published article or two for the case study, working on a series of questions for the case study, and participating in discussions with your team. In addition, there are 2 examinations and a final paper. To balance your workload across the semester, we suggest that you read ahead in the textbook, at least to familiarize yourself with it, during the weeks before the posting of the first examination. After the first examination is finished, read over the articles you will be critiquing for the final paper and begin drafting your final paper. See the final paper instructions on the website for the coverage of the paper and how it's supposed to be put together. Then, work on the second examination when it is posted, and after it is finished, go back and complete your paper. With this schedule, you can spread the workload over the entire semester and can have the benefit of time and reflection in writing your final paper. And now, to elicit your sympathy and understanding, I want to call your attention to some of the challenges of teaching an introductory course in epidemiology. First, since this graduate-level course does not follow an undergraduate epidemiology course, students vary greatly in their previous exposure to epidemiology and to the many related fields. That means that nearly everything I might say is going to be too familiar to some of you and too unfamiliar to others. Second, since Epi 160 is a required course, there is a diversity of interest, from those who are excited at the opportunity to take epidemiology to those who are taking the course under duress. Third, as I mentioned earlier, epidemiologic concepts are still evolving, so there remains more inconsistency and confusion than will be the case in another decade or two. What are the objectives of this course? We have listed seven. First, to understand measures of disease occurrence and correlates in populations. Since epidemiology studies populations, we need to have measures that quantify the occurrence and presence of disease and the presence of exposures that influence them in groups of people. Second, to explain the basic approach to investigating disease outbreaks. Third, to explain the relative strengths and limitations of different epidemiologic study designs. And fourth, to identify and control major sources of error in community health studies. Every science has to contend with error, but since epidemiology is an observational science rather than a laboratory science, our abilities to avoid and control error through experimental design, such as standard temperature and pressure, for example, are very limited. People are not easy to study. The fifth objective is to weigh the evidence from different epidemiologic studies. Rarely does a single epidemiologic study establish anything. There are too many possible sources of error and other influences to consider. So, weighing the evidence from different studies is an essential part of interpreting findings and reaching conclusions. The sixth objective is to understand strategies to evaluate public health interventions. And the seventh objective is to appreciate the complexities in applying scientific evidence in making policy. Epidemiology helps to provide the scientific basis for public health practice and policy, but the connection is often not straightforward. Appreciating the complexities is an important part of using epidemiologic data appropriately. Since epidemiology is a course, we of course have to have some evaluation and grading. Grading in Epi 160 is explained in the syllabus on the course website. Grades are based on various indicators of both learning and class participation. Even if you do not do well on examinations, you can still do well in this course. Speaking of grading, I need to mention that all graded work for this course comes under the honor code of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Honesty and integrity of academic work is vital to scholarly activity. You, as students, depend on your instructors to be truthful in the material we present and to be honest with you in our interactions. All of us depend on researchers and writers to be honest in their descriptions of what they have done and what they have found. The occasional lapses of integrity serve to remind us that without integrity, what use would the information in scientific journals be? Integrity of academic work is the responsibility of each of us as individuals and of all of us collectively. Your participation in Epi 160 implies full observance of the honor code. What does the honor code require? The honor code requires that all graded work avoid cheating and plagiarism and be accompanied by a pledge. Academic cheating includes unauthorized copying and unauthorized collaboration or use of notes or books on examinations, and plagiarism. Plagiarism is the intentional representation of another person's words, thoughts, or ideas as one's own. These issues are most likely not new to you, but if you are uncertain in any specific instance, ask an instructor. Since cheating and plagiarism involve misrepresentation, raising the question with an instructor demonstrates that you are not attempting to mislead or misrepresent. So, integrity is essential. We also encourage you to partake fully of this opportunity to learn and begin to practice epidemiology. Read, discuss, ask questions, attend seminars, explore websites, design studies, collect and analyze data, find answers, and apply epidemiology to your own profession. Many of your colleagues practice epidemiology even if they don't say so. Too often, when people go to earn their living, they focus primarily on how much money they can make, and they give too little attention to how their actions will affect others. Many of the public health problems of today arise or are compounded by people's actions as they go about making money. Public health professionals work to improve the lives of others. I thank you and congratulate you on joining this noble calling, and I look forward to sharing the excitement of epidemiology with you over the coming months. Thank you very much for listening.